Your volume is on and turned up. External speakers or personal headphones give you the best audio. You do have individual controls for your screen. Part of this introduction is just to give you time to make those adjustments to sound. Audio and video may at times freeze for you or not be in sync. This has to do with connectivity, and unfortunately, it's out of our control. It could be on your end, it could be on our presenter's end. But it usually is not doesn't usually affect the recording. Want to thank you for joining us for this event. We appreciate your feedback and your topic suggestions, both of which we will ask you about in a survey after the presentation is over. I'd like to know who's with us today. In addition to your hellos in the chat box, we have a brief poll that we'll present on screen here in a second. Just asking people to define primarily what's your role. You may hold several of these positions, but in terms of working with students with visual impairments, are you primarily a teacher of the visually impaired, a therapy service professional that may include OT, PT, speech language? Are you a clinical or medical professional, such as an ophthalmologist? Are you an O&M professional? We're asking about them separately because we're interested in reaching out to them. Paraprofessional, an educational professional such as a classroom teacher or inclusive teacher. Are you a parent, family, or guardian, or do you have some other role? And I can see nearly 50% of you are TVIs. That's not unusual. That's our primary audience, but we do see some number of O&Ms and teachers here on with us as well, and some others, and that's very enticing. Unfortunately, we don't have a comment box, so I can't ask you what you do, but we'll capture the chat and see whether some of you have given us some other ideas. Just interested in who we're meeting.
Name up there.
Are you seeing your fan club, Rajiv?
My good friend Linda.
Thanks, Valerie. Let me go ahead and introduce our speakers. Rajiv Panikkar is a CLVT with the Arizona State Schools for the Deaf and Blind. He has extensive experience in residential schools, public schools, and at the University of Colorado as an assistive technology specialist. In addition to his low vision credentials, he holds certifications as a comms and a TVI. Presenting as well is Joanne Szabo, full-time physical therapist and board-certified pediatric clinical specialist at the Arizona State Schools for the Deaf and Blind. Joanne brings more than 25 years of pediatric experience, including having worked in the NICU, acute care, early intervention, and school-based services. And that is enough out of me. I'm going to give you guys the floor and welcome back to Perkins.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. We're just going to go jump right into it because I think we're going to be pressed for time. So, what we're going to try and cover today is understand the challenges TVIs and O&Ms have for students identified with CVI, recognize the importance of team collaboration, and also discuss how to build an FVA for a student identified with CVI. And apply collaborative strategies, understand the importance of reassessment. We are not going to be covering or going into depth Roman's work. We need to. Can I forward these slides or do you guys do that?
You can indeed. You should be able to find the arrow right underneath. And I did neglect to mention that we had had a long talk before before everybody joined the room that our goal of this presentation today is really to talk about Rajiv and Joanne's work with their particular students. We're not going to be able to actually, teach the CVI range or dorsal ventral stream or Dutton's tree of vision. These are all topics that we have resources that we can link you to and other webinars that go into depth with that. But in the interest of time, we've really encouraged Rajiv and Joanne to concentrate on the collaborative effort and the style that they've developed together.
Okay, so I'm really happy to see there's two therapists out there. That makes me really happy. Just a shout out to you guys. But as far as challenges, we know, and I'm sure all of you know, working with kids with CVI is not easy. It's hard. These kids are all different. They're in different phases. And that's why we put this together, because we've had a lot of people say to us, you know, how do you do this? And here at Arizona State School for the Deaf and the Blind, no one person can do this alone. To do it effectively, we all have to work together to get this done. So, you know, I think the main thing is a lot of people, including TBIs, are not familiar with CVI. And I think that's because it falls in between this gray area of the neurological insult and the visual problems that result from it. So I think all of us, it's okay to say, you know, we don't really know what to do. We need more training. There's lots of good resources now, the Dutton and Lewick book, Vision in the Brain, and the Roman Lancy CVI scale as well, plus others. But we're going to mainly talk about those because those are the main ones that we use. So moving right along. And this is what we basically preach, is that you have to use collaboration, because you can't do this alone. And if you try, it's very frustrating. And I know it's hard for itinerants to collaborate, but if you can get a team together and you know, every person has to be responsible for picking up the book and learning how to work with kids that have CVI, because it's not something that you can just pick up a score sheet and score it. I have to actually understand what's going on with the child before you can actually use some of these tools. So
I mean, this slide here, we're going to be talking about, you know, in the early stages, CVI will cover up any other ocular impairment, cannot perform traditional FVA in most cases. The TVI O&M are the lead for the FVA, for us at least here, but other trained professionals are needed since CVI affects many behavioral areas. The team's job is to ensure that the full range of effects of CVI are appraised. When we work together, we spend a lot of time with interviews, and we'll get to that later in observations, but as the lead, sometimes I collaborate solely with Joanne, then we spread out from there using all the other team members. So a solid understanding of CVI is critical when assessing and administrating testing to a student with CVI. Testing items requiring the student to use vision must be within the student's visual capabilities. And that's where we use the team. We use everyone on the team to say, okay, what are your goals? What do you want to get from this? What do the parents want? And then we move on from there. And most of this is already covered in the first part. So if you're returning, this is most likely an overview for you. Those of you who are taking this as your first one, I believe the PowerPoints and handouts are available through Perkins as well. So preparation for the FVA, we gather information, medical records, review, interview, family caregivers, school team members, observations. We rely heavily on observations. Home, we try our best to do a home visit. Oftentimes that doesn't happen, so we rely on information from the folks at home. Lead evaluator to bring info back. If the home visit is made by the lead evaluator, they bring back the information to the team. School, and then we have the direct assessment itself. Medical records review, you know, here we run the gamut. We have reports from eye care specialists. The TVI can assist in interpretation of the eye report. Sometimes you don't get a complete picture of the vision from the eye doctor's report. And especially with our CVI kiddos, the eye report may be normal. So evaluation important for the health of the eye and to document pathology. Often to determine if refractive error is present, if glasses prescribed, they should be worn during the assessment.
Okay, so another part of the medical records review that's important is the actual medical piece of it, besides the eye piece. And that's because with CVI, you have an insult to the brain. And so obviously, if you have a child who comes to you with a diagnosis of CVI, it's pretty straightforward. You can look at the history. You probably see something as listed in this list here some one of these things probably happened during birth, after birth, could be trauma, could be, you know, a middle school student, any age. But the main thing is, why I'm bringing this up is because often you have kids that aren't diagnosed with CBI, and they're visually, I have this happen to me a lot, where you know something's going on, especially those kids in the later phases. You know something isn't right, but they don't yet have a diagnosis. And you start to wonder, you know, what's going on with the student. You really have to go back to the medical records and look at what happened. Because if they have a history of these sorts of things in their medical records, that'll start helping you piece together the puzzle that their CBI may be involved. Even children with other ocular impairments can also have CBI overlaying those problems. So, you know, a lot of times I'll get them for physical therapy and I'll be working with them and wondering why, you know, we're having real problems with, you know, distance viewing or going outside and they're just not using their vision well. And I'm wondering, you know, something is going on. And often I'll go back to the medical records and I'll start to look for these clues. So these are important clues, especially when you see things like areas of the brain that are affected, like hydrocephalus around those ventricles where the vision processing centers kind of encircle those areas. It gives you a real clue that something else could be going on and we need to send them back. Or I'll talk to Rajiv and we'll need to send them back, you know, to the doctor or make a recommendation. The parents take them for another eye exam.
And, you know, just to jump on here, sometimes a lot of our kids that who have been identified with CBI don't have really good eye exams. So I'm not saying that these are the same, but oftentimes we can tease some of that information out from a report from a neurologist, for example. Right. So, and we try to use as much information as we can, but sometimes we just have to rely on the neurologist's report because the eye doctor was unable to evaluate the student.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So starting the FEA, and like I said, here, the TBI, they're the ones who take the lead. But I will tell you, because we're all interacting with the family, sometimes, you know, the TBI, if we don't have a CBI diagnosis, isn't even brought in yet. And so I could be working with a child who has a hearing impairment, but I'm starting to ask some of these questions because I'm wondering if I'm not seeing some CBI involved. So the interview is the first step. And obviously talking to the family is critical because the parents know what's going on at home, how they use their vision at home, what they like, what they don't like. The parents are really key in getting the information that you need to start to piece together the puzzle. I think the important questions that you have to ask, I've listed them here. And if you look at the Roman Lanty book, she has a guide to parent interview, and I even put the page on there. It's a really good resource. And the things you need to ask, you know, what does the child prefer to look at? And does the child have a preferred color? You know, when is their vision at its best? And the reason you're asking these questions is because these kids, especially in the early phases, you're going to have a really limited amount of time that you're going to get them to work for you. Most of the time, these kids have very low tolerance for using their vision. And so it's like you want to try to set them up in their most optimal environment, wherever that may be. It may not be in the classroom. Here at ASDB, often down where I am in our therapy room, we have a lot more rooms. We can darken things. We can, you know, cover windows. Right or wrong, that's just how it is here. That's the kind of one of the better places to get the kids into a more secluded environment for testing. I can put them in a stander. I can contain them. You know, I'm talking about the initial assessment because if you walk into the classroom and you try to get their visual attention and you're not getting, you know, anything accomplished, you may have to back up and say, well, where is the parent seeing them using their vision? And, you know, when are they looking at things at home and are they? And those little pieces of information is that you have to kind of take all that and put it together and figure out that's how I need to start my FEA, because otherwise you're just spinning your wheels and you may get no information and you'll be really frustrated because the student will fatigue really quickly.
And you have to be really careful. Oftentimes what happens here, I'm just going to throw this out, is Joanne would be transitioning a student from, say, the playground to a classroom or whatever. And my room is fairly close to the playground, and she'll just pop in with the kiddo and we'll take a look, we'll discuss, and we go from there. The biggest mistake we can, as TDIs, that we tend to do is that we come into a classroom with a bag of stuff and not really knowing the situation or the student. And we don't rely, often we don't rely on people that know the student best. And that's where the collaboration comes in. So the interview, we've included a handout that you should see down there. It's a PDF, it's a team interview form. We send this out either we do it in person or we send it out electronically or complete it over the phone. There are multiple ways of doing it. For example, if I the most recent one I sent out to Joanne, I almost got something like War and Peace, but it's all important stuff. But it's and then we combine all that information, so we get information on what the needs are, areas of concerns, documented questions about vision, goals identified, and it develops a picture of the whole child and the current participation at school, because some of our kids with multiple disabilities, we don't get that information when we see them around campus. We get that information from collaborating with our other professionals. How providers see students' vision use in a variety of environments, whether it's in PT, in the cafeteria, during communications, all those areas are very important. Behaviors. This is a big one. Medication that may affect testing. So sometimes we need to coordinate with after when we're doing this, we need to talk to the student health center or the nurse. Any other questions or concerns that they might have. The form contents. This is what is on the form. Some of it, I don't stick to this. After I observe the child, I have a rough idea of what I need to take out, what I can ask, what I should ask. So use of vision, changes in vision, additional disabilities, reading level, visual difficulties with school tasks, favorite tasks and visual difficulties with those tasks, low vision devices if any, best lighting, glare protection, mobility concerns, daily schedule. Daily schedule is basically for me so that I know when to go in to observe and spend some time with the student. This, the last item here, the goals for the FEA, that is the most important thing, and I shared this in part one, is that the reason I put this down there is each professional may or may not have the same goal, and it's my job as the TDI to address each and every one of those. If I don't address those goals, then I haven't done a complete FEA. So during the information that I've gathered during this process, this will help me identify what I need in terms of tools.
Or toys,
Toys.
or lights,
Exactly.
or reflective materials.
What's going to motivate the student? It's
Color.
a color, a variety of things. And if I don't spend time with the other professionals like Joanne or speech language or mobility, I'm not going to get that information with the parent. What does this child like to do, use at home? And sometimes pre-practice is necessary. If I hand someone like Joanne the Leia puzzle to practice with the student until they get familiar maybe with the shapes or the colors, at least I'll have a starting point as opposed to me just walking in with the puzzle and expecting the student to complete that task. I also, this is a good time to determine which staff will be needed to assist you, whether it's PTOT, speech, O&M, or oftentimes it could just be the paraprofessional. But we always try to work together as a team and schedule some time that we can do that together.
Okay, so once you have the interview completed with the family, with the staff at school, using the form that we have provided, and again, that form comes from the TDI, just to kind of gather and contain all the information. The next thing then is observation. And I want to say that sometimes, let's say if the TBI goes out to the home, they're interviewing and observing at the same time. I mean, they're watching the child interact with toys or whatever the child's doing, kind of an informal observation while they're asking the parents questions. So some of that is done simultaneously in certain environments. And then, you know, here at school, like Rajiv, he may come down and observe while I have the student in PT doing some things, or, you know, I'm in the classroom with the student, depending on what we're doing, what the routine is, he may be observing during that time. And the thing with the FVA for a child with CVI that's important here to keep in mind is when you do the FVA, you want it to be in an optimal environment. So you know how that child can visually function, where they're at. Because when you start adding in all the environmental pieces, you know, that takes them down to a different level. And you want to know where they're really functioning at their best to start. So you know where we really want to work to start to get that visual attention initially, especially if they're in phase one. So under observation, the things you want to think about, or you know, things Rajiv would probably think about is, you know, talking to us, he would say, you know, how are they doing with noise? Does it have to be really quiet? And, you know, distance viewing, are they able to see anything? Is everything being pulled, you know, right up here? How are they doing, you know, with cluttered backgrounds, familiar objects? I mean, it's pretty easy if he comes in to talk to me or the OT or the speech therapist, who are all familiar with CVI, for us to give him this information, because we've already been working with these kids. I mean, usually I've already had these kids in my department, or I've been in the classroom for weeks or months, and I know, you know, I know what color ball he's going to look at, and all the other ones he's just going to, let's say, scoot right by. Or I know, you know, if I give him something shiny, one of the shiny yellow Mylar pom-poms or something, that he'll, you know, crawl over to it. And if I put something else out there, he'll just crawl and buy it. So I can give Rajiv all of that information and then kind of set up the environment for him. So when he comes in, he can then observe those things himself. But those are during the observation, those are the things you want to keep in mind. And again, looking for the color preferences. And if you don't have a team that understands CVI, your job's going to be a lot harder, but you will have to go in and start looking for and asking the questions about color preference. And, you know, are you seeing them really only looking at things that move, or looking at the shiny metal, you know, post, or out the window, or up at the ceiling because, you know, there's a fan or there's something up there that's shiny.
And that's what I was just going to add, is that when you go in and observe, you have to look at what is in that specific environment. You know, we always discuss, where are the windows? Where's the student being placed in reference to the windows and the lights and the fan and all those other materials? So on the back of the team interview form, or when I go in for my observation form, on the back page, I actually draw a map of the classroom and the situation where the student is in. That mainly is for me. So when I refer back to the team, I can say, okay, he was placed here in this position. That's this far away from an object. And I can do that with that picture in mind, as opposed to saying, oh, what happened that day? Do you remember we used this? So that way I can draw that picture. So I always have a couple of blank pages on my observation form so that I can draw the map.
So the other thing, the next two slides talk about additional behavioral clues that you may be looking for when you're doing your observation, or questions you may be asking. And I put these in there because, personally, I think kids who are in like phase three are challenging for me. They're not as obvious. It's really hard to pick out what's going on. If a new child comes to our school and they have, let's say, phase three, or they're not even diagnosed with CVI, but they may have some of these kinds of behavioral clues, it's challenging and it's difficult sometimes to figure out what's going on and actually even draw the conclusion that it may be CVI. So some of these come from The Vision in the Brain, the Dutton and Lewick book. And that book, I find personally, gives me more assistance with those higher kids that are like in phase three, because they start talking about the dorsal and the ventral stream and the visual processing. And so if you have a child that's maybe not in phase one, you know, not really looking at gazing at lights and not, you know, doing hand flicking maybe to stimulate their vision or using toys that like to spin and all those things that most of those kids like to do, you know, you may have a parent or a teacher that says, you know, there they just run out in front of the traffic, or, you know, they reach and they're not even looking at what they're reaching for, or, you know, they can't seem to find their toy in a toy box and it's full of toys. And I tell them, go get the whatever. And, you know, they just can't see it. So that gives you clues that, okay, we're still seeing some of those characteristics of CVI. And then the next page, again, talks about other kinds of things, having distress, you know, in crowded places, not really being able to see the boundaries on the floor. And of course that could be a child that has depth perception issues and other things going on. But when you kind of, again, piece all these puzzle pieces together, it starts to build a picture for you. And those are the things you want to keep in mind.
So, I mean, some of these items here on this slide here, you know, you have to note the responses to vision stimulation, direct reactions, following or short fixations, reaching, turning head to stimulus, turning head away and reaching, indirect reactions, avoiding, closing eyes, stilling or quieting, smiling or expression change, changing posture. Now, a lot of this, those of you who are TVIs who conduct learning media assessments, you can pull some of this information out from your sensory channels inventory. And that's the LMA that we traditionally use with a lot of our students.
I want to add something, Rajiv. So one other thing I was going to add to that too is that's also another reason why it's good to bring in a teacher or a therapist or somebody who knows the student. Because if you're getting those indirect responses, you know, you're not getting a lot of direct responses, but you're noticing a change in posture. You're noticing, you know, that maybe they're smiling differently, or you're getting those indirect responses to their vision being stimulated. Sometimes if you don't know the child very well, it's hard to pick up on those really subtle nuances and changes. But like someone like me who may work with the student frequently, I will know what that is, and I can kind of clue the TBI into, oh, look, you know, look what they're doing. Yeah.
Yeah, and you have to also keep in mind that this is going not going to, you have to be able to put in that time for it in the terms of the collaboration, because, you know, as you all know, students are sick, they don't show up, you know, then we have to readjust on days that we can. Our kids, we are fortunate that we have the PT room, we've got speech language, we've got OT, they've got the low vision area, so there are lots of areas that we can possibly try a lot of different things at different times.
Right. And also on this slide, I noted, I use a lot of video. I use my phone. And as long as you have parent consent, sometimes we just videotape it and we watch it later, because, or I'll bring it over to Rajiv and I'll show him, you know, what I got, because sometimes it's so subtle, or you're one person is busy doing one thing that you just didn't have time to really either note how long they were attending, or, you know, there's different things. And so using video helps to go back and look at it later. Also, I noted here, there's a form for recording level of visual attention and activities. It just gives you an objective way to document what you're seeing. And that's actually in the Vision in the Brain book, the Dutton Lewick book, in that chapter on page 404. It talks about ranking the child's visual attention from no visual attention to very attentive. And it, you know, kind of gives you a way of writing it all down, so when you go back for a reassessment, you can then see that progress in a very objective way.
And videotaping is actually a really important piece, because if you don't have an opportunity and you're alone with the student, that's the best time to do it, so you can share that video. Here at our school, our parents usually sign permissions during registration. As an itinerant in the past, what we used to do is at the first IEP meeting, if we couldn't get it before then, we always had this paperwork for the parents to sign, and that's usually a helpful way to go about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So again, we're still talking about observations. We haven't gotten to the direct assessment yet, which is all, like I said, this is all very, very important, because you need to know, you know, the tools you need to bring in when you're doing that direct assessment. So again, we were talking about at home, you know, you're going to start your observation right away as you're talking to the parent. Initially, you know, it's going to be just let the child, you know, interact, play, whatever the child wants to do, sort of spontaneous play like you normally would probably do. And then you maybe start making some modifications, you know, changing the environment, repositioning the child, offering different materials, altering the way you present the material, just to kind of see how the child is responding to some of those changes in intervention. And then at school, you're going to sort of do the same thing, but you have to figure out the child's daily routine, because that's really important. Again, like we mentioned, you need to do your initial FVA testing in the optimal environment if you can, so that you get their best performance. But as you start working with the child, of course, you're going to have to address all the different areas that the child functions in, because that's our job. I mean, we have to hopefully have this child working towards functional vision use throughout the day. And sometimes it can't happen right away, and you want it to, but you just can't do that. So you've got to figure out the best environment, the optimal environment, and then you start applying them to those different areas throughout the child's day. And so, like, you know, you may be thinking of the cafeteria during eating. If they eat in the cafeteria, transitions, that's often, you know, what I do. I'm also in PE sometimes, spontaneous play. We have play groups, ready bodies that I run with kids. So they'll be down there doing that with me. So there's all kinds of different areas, depending on how that child's day is broken out, that we need to eventually make our observations. Now for testing, I would say you would want to observe, but a lot of times with these kids, we'll see them doing a lot of sort of stimming and not really using their vision in a lot of the environments because they're not set up yet. When we can finally start to do that, then we kind of chunk it, you know, piece by piece, trying to work on getting each environment in a more optimal sort of setup. But that takes time.
Yeah, and you also have to, you know, like most of you are aware that lighting and glare is a big issue for a lot of our kids with CVI. So we have to be cognizant of those issues. And that's where, you know, sometimes the cafeteria may not be the best place, even though it's a good place to observe the transitions, etc. It may not be a good place to do a bulk of the work, even though it may be quiet, because the glare in most school cafeterias, including ours, is not good.
Right.
So, so I think those are the factors that we coordinate and collaborate with to decide where we need to do the assessment or the observation to determine what we need to be doing.
Okay. Direct assessment.
Direct assessment. Okay. Here's the piece that we always try to hit home. Direct assessment is usually maybe for a typical kiddo with ocular impairment, maybe 5% of direct assessing. The rest of it is observations and interviews. With CVI kiddos, it's pretty much the same. You're not spending a lot of time with direct assessment. You're gathering information so you can do this. And you're going to hear this a lot from us, is that the direct assessment piece is on a continuum. It goes on. It's not just once and you're done. It goes on for 3 times during the school year, 3 to 5 times during the school year, so we can get all that information. Because the needs change, the students change, the vision change, health issues may change. So we have to gather all of this information. So during the direct assessment, we're looking at students' unique needs, the range of CVI behaviors noted, looking at visual functions, functional vision, visual processing, motor function, auditory processing, environmental issues, social and emotional issues. Students with profound, is this you? So I can't remember. I think this
sure,
is mine. Students with profound involvement may be difficult to test as CVI dominates the visual responses. And here the areas that we're looking at are functional acuity and ocular motor. Functional acuity review, we have 3 types. We have awareness acuity, identification, and preferred viewing distance. Definition for awareness acuity is the furthest possible distance at which the presence of any form is first detected. This is all coming from a collaboration of low vision books that we've had. The big, can you pass me that Foundations book, please? So it can be in this book, the low vision book.
The Bible?
The Bible or the O&M book. You'll see a lot of this stuff in there. And this is typically in, this is an excerpt from our functional vision report. So it's an example from a report. And this was actually written by a graduate student in the vision program assessing a kiddo with CVI who was interning here. So we have the example here is location indoors in Ann's home. Lighting two west-facing windows with blinds halfway closed in one window. Other window, blinds open on a partly cloudy day. No additional lighting indoors. So it says, N was first aware of a person at 15 feet. He indicated this by smiling. Due to indoor space constraints, he could be aware of an individual from a further distance. These results may vary based on lighting conditions. Identification acuity, the furthest possible distance at which a detected form is first correctly identified. And here's an excerpt. And gave his mom a different smile than he did when looking at the evaluator from 10 feet away. This suggests he could possibly identify his mom from this distance. Preferred viewing distance definition, the most comfortable distance for viewing a detected form. And here's an excerpt from the report from between 3 to 5 feet. Away and was able to hold his gaze on his mom for approximately 2 to 4 minutes. And this gives us information on, you know, where we need to have materials, where a person needs to be in order for a student to react. And this is all critical information for us as we work as teams. Oculomotor function, this is what we had talked before. We're talking about fixation. This is all on your PowerPoint, so I'm not going to read all these items up. Accommodation, tracking, shift of gaze, scanning, eye preference. Sometimes the eye preference is the most difficult thing for us to work with. And a lot of our information we get from, oops, this book, Look at Me, Resource Manual for the Development of Residual Vision in Multiply Impaired Children. Some of you may have it. If you don't, I think this is currently out of print. I'm not sure it's available anymore. You may want to contact Salus University to see if it's available. It may be, but I'm not sure. My copy is from 1990, so I still use it. Systematic presentation of visual stimuli. Choose environments that afford best performance. Start with natural light. Darken room with no response. Additional light on viewing objects. As TVIs, we always carry a whole bunch of stuff. We are fortunate that we are able to control lighting in most of our rooms, so that's always a good thing. And the goal is to document visual potential in optimal conditions. Information from observations should tell us what to eliminate from this process. So observations will tell us that we need to eliminate complex backgrounds, etc.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when you're doing your direct assessment, some of the tools that we use would be the Roman Lancy CVI range. There we go. And there's a comprehensive model assessment in the Dutton Lewitt book. It's a 3-tier model. And then there's also, if any of you have heard Millie Smith, the sensory learning kit, a portion of that has a functional vision observational assessment within it. And so some people also use that. But here, typically, for the kids that are in the earlier phases, we use the CVI range. And like I said, the TBI is always the lead, but you're going to find in certain places there's other people who have CVI endorsements. There's other people who have taken the Roman Lancy class and have worked with a lot of kids with CVI, and they also can help to score the CVI range in different environments. They can do reassessments that will help, you know, keep the team on track, because the TVI can't always come back. Like Rajiv said, you know, 3 to 5 times a year, he may do a formal reassessment, but I'm reassessing that student almost every single time I have that student, constantly looking at what the vision is doing, how can we progress them if they're starting to meet some of those goals. So the CVI range, just quickly, I have four slides. And just go back, Rajiv. I have four slides. The first one, it just talks about the range for those of you who haven't used it. It's for infants to adults. You can use it on anyone. You're identifying the presence of the visual behaviors that are associated with CVI, and you're determining like what degree do those characteristics interfere with visual functioning. And so you'll see here this range. It goes from zero, which is no visual functioning, to 10. That's the CVI range. And you're plotting some points on that range to figure out where the child is functioning. So the things, the behaviors in the Roman Lancy CVI range that you're looking at are here, listed here. And if you have the book and you learn to administer it, these are all the things that you're looking at on that range. And so the range, you come up with two different rating scales. And so there's one that's across CVI characteristics, and there's another that's within CVI characteristics. And you have to score each one. And these two ratings come up with your final CVI range. And so your range, depending, and when we talk about our case study, we'll go over that more, is going to tell you if they're in phase one, phase two, or phase three. And the kids that are up on these higher functioning ranges, 7 to 10, that's phase three, they actually have an extension chart in the Roman Lancy book that allows you to gather more information, because as I was telling you before, some of those kids are pretty hard to tease out what's going on because they actually have better vision. But there's still some processing things that aren't right with those kids. And so you can get more information and you can plot that on the charts that are in that book for those kids on the extension chart. So just so you know, that does exist. And also, the CVI range has gone through testing and it has been shown to have a very high reliability, which is important for any test that we're going to use. So as I said, that you get the three phases, and here's the score. 0 to 3 is phase one, 3.25 to 7 is phase two, and 7.25 to 10 is phase three. There's a CVI resolution chart where you chart everything on that, and that helps you come up with your IEP goals and your instruction for activities for the child, because you don't want to program for these children any higher than where they're at, because they will fail. You have to program at the level they're at. And actually, I have I don't know if you can see this. This is a CVI resolution chart, if you can see it right here. It comes from there. You see how it's all marked up? You can't see it very well, but this is from her book. And you literally just circle things and make X's on things, and it kind of gives you a functioning guide to set your goals. And then the Dutton and Lewick book has a comprehensive three-tier model that it kind of tells you in tier one, these are the things you're going to test for in tier two. Tier two actually has two different branches depending on how functional the child's vision is. These are the things you test. And in child three, in tier three, these are the things you test. And so tier one, obviously, are your more like your phase one lower level students. And so it's a different way of assessing the child. And that would be found in the Dutton and Lewick book.
So the written report, you know, we use a template here, and we'll be happy to share that with you. But the both books have great samples of reports, or either or, depending which you're using or which method you would like to use, that would be great reports to use. But if you do need a template, we do have one. And the importance is, you know, you want to, whatever method you're using, whether Roman Lansky or Lewick and Dutton, whatever information you gather, for example, if you're using a table for Roman Lansky, always try and include that table or that graphic of that table in your report so that it's there, as opposed to someone else going back to try to look for that information. Assessment?
Reassessment.
It's, you know, it's ongoing, as I was said, 3 to 5 times per year, according to Roman Lansky's book. You know, Lewick and Dutton said ongoing assessment. So it's something that you really want to be aware of. Oftentimes, what we have seen from reports that come in from school districts, from students from other school districts that come into our program here, is that the CBI range may have been done once at the beginning of the school year. And it's a new school year, and that's all we have. So that's we have to do a lot of work to get to where we are going.
Okay, so the last 15 minutes, we're going to go over a case study of one of our little guys here that we work with, and it'll kind of help put into perspective how the FEA was conducted on this student. So he came into our school. You go ahead and click it over. He was 6 years old. He had a profound hearing loss. He had suffered from meningitis, and he had hydrocephalus. So that's two of the big red flags for CBI. He was diagnosed with CBI. He also had multiple disabilities from the meningitis. He had both of his legs were amputated. Part of his fingers were amputated. And this was when he was very young. So he didn't have any language. And so he came to us, and go ahead. Here he is again, like the picture you saw in the beginning. All he wanted to do was find a light source. And you see him here. He crawled over to this light source. And if you can see in the picture, he's flicking his fingers. He's looking at his hand. He's stimulating his vision going like this. And the other picture prior to that, he had a yellow spinner here. He pulled that over and sat down, and he would spin it in circles right there in the light. And that's only time he would use his vision. And so when he came in, the teacher was really frustrated because she couldn't get him to sit in his chair. He was crawling all over the place. All he would do is try to crawl out the door and look for a light, like down the hall. And pretty much that was it all day long. And so we started working with him in physical therapy, and I had put him in a stander. And that was the picture you saw previously with him standing in the stander, because that's how we could kind of contain him. Go ahead, Rajiv. So when I first evaluated him and with the TBI, we looked at the Roman Lancy scale, and he was a 1.75 to 2.0. That's phase one. And so clearly we knew where he was falling. It was pretty apparent, but we had a starting point for him. So we used the CBI range, and really there was no other FEA. That was the FEA. There was no other testing that could be done on him because he just wasn't using his vision. I mean, light gazing was really the only thing he was doing other than staring at things that would spin in the light. So the assessment was completed by the team. All of us got together and we figured out, you know, how are we going to assess him? Where are we going to assess him? I'm going to put him in the stander because we needed to contain him. He didn't have any hearing. He didn't have any language. So that made it even harder. It was all basically observation. We did talk to the family. They were just frustrated. They didn't even think he would ever be able to really use his vision. So that
was... there wasn't enough information in the eye doctor's report because the eye doctor was not able to assess him properly.
Right.
So the report came in with CBI with a whole bunch of question marks around it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. So
right.
We didn't have anything on the eye doctor's report.
Right. So... All right, so what we did, what we figured out was that he liked working in the dark, and he liked bubbles. And that took us a lot of sort of hit and miss of trying different things. And here he's with the speech therapist, and we had a light, is a blue light, a light that we were shining on the bubbles. The blue light seemed to illuminate the bubbles the best, and he really liked that. And that was the first time we really started seeing him attending to something. I don't have a picture of it, but he would really turn away for a long period of time. He would use his vision for very brief periods of time, and he would fatigue really quickly. But that was the beginning. And so we couldn't even really, in the classroom, we couldn't even really get that from him. We were having to start in a totally different environment just to figure out, okay, what can we get from him and how can we get him to start using his vision? And that's what we did. As you see here, we moved the bubbles later to a room which was lighted, and you can see how he's using his vision. His field loss, he likes to lay on his back. He's turning his head up to look at those bubbles, but he really, really liked the bubbles. And we had to use that as a motivator to try to see how his vision was functioning mm-hmm. in other environments, because we knew, you know, we could get him to respond for very short periods of time with the bubbles. And so again, this is all like an ongoing assessment. It's all, you know, the FEA was started with that baseline number, but we're still, you know, it's an ongoing process. And you'll see here, we found out that initially yellow was his favorite color. He liked the yellow ball because the ball moved. So those were all the things that we had to work with him.
Yeah, and in this, not counting the bubbles, but in one of the situations, he had dumped out a basket of balls, the different colored balls, and he consistently found the yellow one.
All right. So this one here, this is a little later, but I put this in there because fatigue is such a huge issue. I mean, you can see here, I had him just for a few minutes working, and I was trying to get him to put his finger in the hole. And we had you guys are probably familiar with this thing with the wooden dowels that go in there, trying just to see if we could get him to, and I mean, after a few minutes, he was done. He was fatigued. And so those are the things, you know, that we have to kind of communicate to the team. I'm trying to push him a little bit to see what we can get from him. And then, you know, this is what we get. He just kind of poops out on us. So as we were going on, we were consulting with the TVI the whole time. And so as he was progressing, what we were trying to do is move him to more 2D material. Now, this is, we had reassessed him a second time. And at this point, he was at 4 to 4.75 on the CVI range. So he had moved into phase two now that we had been working with him throughout the year. And so we were adding color. Now you can see we're adding red. He had been just preferring yellow, and we were working with red, adding a second color. Fatigue was still an issue in phase two. Controlling the complexity was a huge issue for him in phase two. But wanting to start to introduce those 2D models to move to a more functional use of vision. And that's kind of what happens in phase two. So the speech therapist and myself and the TBI, we were all, and including the teacher in the classroom, but we were first in our sort of controlled environment trying to introduce these 2D materials, so in his classroom he could then identify his picture and you know, put that he was there for the day. But we had to actually start with a silhouette of his head because he still wasn't really wanting to look at faces. And so you'll see we started with, I think, a 4x4 because Rajiv was, you know, kind of guiding us on size. And then eventually when he started to actually look at these, when he had us cut it down to 2x2, and we moved him into even smaller pictures as he was progressing. But those are the kind of things that we do in consultation with the TBI. And here you can see the third reassessment we did of him. He was at 5 to 5.5 on the CVI range. And here we were identifying, we're trying to introduce more colors, more complexity. You can see that in this picture, we have some, like his friend's pictures in his classroom now, besides his own picture. He still tended not to look at those. He would often take them off and throw them. And he would want to just look at his own picture. But, you know, we were trying to introduce some of this stuff as he was willing to look and use his vision, as he was resolving. And those in the Roman Lancy book, you will see the ideas that she gives you. And so even though this is more talking about intervention, it also goes along with reassessment, because you're reassessing. And that's why you need a team, because as a TBI, or an O&M, or whoever's doing the lead, you can't be there all the time. Like, you can't, unless you have the luxury of being in that classroom every day, you can't really be doing a lot of this. You can be telling them and consulting, and they can be consulting with you, but you have to have these team members that are actually implementing these changes. And then here, this is him now, when he's actually ready for a new reassessment. We haven't done it yet, but you can see he's really starting. This year, I was so excited when he came back because he's actually starting to use his vision more. I mean, he really still likes balls, but now he's using a purple ball. He's throwing to a hoop. And that hoop, actually, I put a red rope light around it. I don't have it in that picture, but it seems to work better for him because, again, we're still in phase two. So we're still using shiny objects and lights and things to attract his attention. But he's starting to show more purposeful play. He got onto that platform swing himself. He started swinging himself. I was like, oh my gosh, even though it still involves movement. And so he's still getting that visual stimulation. But last year, he would have never done that. So, you know, it's these kinds of changes that as you move forward, you continually do that reassessment. And as a TVI, you come in, you do that initial, you know, scale, Roman Lancy scale. That may be all you can do. And that is your FVA. And if you read the Dr. Roman's information, she'll say the FEA is often just the scale, and that's all you can do to start. And that's fine, because you know what? We know the baseline, and then we move from there, and we continually reassess them and show that progress and structure our intervention based on those numbers and those phases.
And just be aware that when you do use the scale as your functional vision, your FEA, make sure you write a written report to reflect that, because just having that data sheet in your file is not going to make sense to anyone, especially those of you that have online IEP programs, etc. It's really difficult when you take that data and infuse it into your IEP, because if there is an audit, I'm not going legal on you, but if there is, they're not going to take that information that's in that IEP per se. They would want to know where that written report is. So always make sure that you have a written report.
Right. And I also want to add that, you know, you want to state that you weren't able to do any ocular motor testing. I mean, at some point, like now with the student, eventually he's going to get to the point where he can start, Rajiv is going to be able to start doing more of that sort of testing. But in the beginning, it just wasn't possible because the CVI was overlaying everything.
Yep.
So you kind of just have to take it step by step, depending where they're at, you know. And I often will tell Rajiv, you know, hey, this is what he's doing. Do you want to look at him? Do you want to see, you know, what you can get out of him now? Maybe we can do a little more.
Yep.
And I will tell you, right now, we're still struggling with distance viewing. I mean, he's still in phase two. Well, I'm going to reassess him, but that's a real challenge. I mean, he's just not using his vision really for any distance viewing yet. So that's something Rajiv's going to have to help me on, is to figure out
what
can
we do. And,
you
want to educate the team. Sometimes oftentimes what happens is a lot of folks don't know what an FEA is. And I'm not talking about the VI folks, but folks outside of our field. They don't know what LMAs are, you know, and the eye reports, what do they mean? It's just an eye report. I don't need that info. But that's all critical for some of our kids with multiple disabilities, you know, to include kiddos with CVI. Teach them about the findings.
Right.
Identify areas that the team can be of assistance to you. The team is always important. The interview form to gather information and then walk your team through the process. What are we going to do next? You know, we always have a recap after we finish and then say, okay, next time we come out, this is what we're going to do, so that we're all on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, it's a little easier because we do have email. We do have close relationships with the folks that we work with, that it's easier for us to do that, including our eye doctors. And then distribute and review the final report to all team members, and say, this is what we came up with. And oftentimes that report could be a joint endeavor and everybody writes that report, you know, so, and that's okay. If that's the case, then that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to come up with a plan.
And I also wanted to add quickly, because I don't think we'll have time for questions, but most physical therapists or therapists in general do not know how to work with kids with visual impairments unless they've had training or they work at a school where they've had that experience. So you may have to, you know, take that lead on doing some education and teaching them. And hopefully, you know, if you have a team, you can build that sort of team, and those people will go out and get some education and learn more about how to work with these kids. It's not that common. So just, you know that you may have to be the one to take that lead and to teach them about some of this stuff. I mean,
And we've listed our references here. We're not going to read them off to you, but they're there on the PowerPoint. We had quite a few references. And good luck collaborating, and thanks for your time, and we hope we've shared some information.
Thank you both so much. This is what we've agreed to do about questions with our presenters, because we are out of time, and I know some of you have been posting questions. But Rajiv and Joanne have offered to take the questions offline, and with their answers, we can create a sort of Q&A document that we'll be able to distribute with the webinar materials. So I would encourage you to go ahead and post questions, excuse me, if you have them. And I don't know for the two of you whether you have time for a couple of questions and comments. It's right at the top of the hour right now. Okay, great. A couple of things were just sort of housekeeping things. Rajiv, you had mentioned when you were talking about look and see that you thought it was out of publication, but that you could check with a specific university. Could you name that?
Salus, it was originally published through Pennsylvania College of Optometry. So I would check with Salus University
Great, that's
because that's
spelled
what PCO became
S-A-L-U-S.
Salus.
Spelling for
Right.
the captioner. And
That's right.
several of you asked about the forms, a couple of forms that were referred to. Right now on your screen, there is a pod that says Files 2 that has components of a functional vision and the team interview form. You can actually download those right now if you want to by selecting them. And when you select them, you'll see a download file button. But these will also be available on the website tomorrow with the recording. The PowerPoint is there now, and if you wanted to, some of you have needed to download that to follow along, that would be fine. So I answered that. Someone chimed in and said, Look at Me is available through Salus and gave us a phone number. So thank you very much. We'll put that in the information document. Really thoughtful for you to share that. Your case study was really interesting, and as we've talked about putting this together, the uniqueness of children and their condition, and so it's always good to sort of talk through someone's story. A lot of us have been trying to find more experience with kids at level 3. Tracy had asked, do you know of any case studies or posted information about a child in level 3, phase 3 CVI that might be useful. I know. Go ahead.
Most, well, for me, I always go to the Dutton and Lewick book because they have the best information I've found thus far on phase three. Now, I do
Tracy.
know that Dr. Roman, I've
She is
heard through the
indeed.
grapevine, is publishing a second book and it's going to have, it's going to have more information on that sort of thing as well. So I think they, the professionals, so to speak, kind of know that a lot of us are struggling in those areas. You're not alone, because I find that very challenging as well. And I would just, the Dutton and Lewick book is my go-to, and they have a lot of examples in there, but I don't know. Rajiv, do you know?
No, I don't know. I, like I said, the two resources that we have are our
Great.
go-to. The Dutton and Lewick is phenomenal. They have case studies on there too. So, I would review those chapters and the case studies and the samples of the reports. If you're struggling with that
Great.
piece, that's really good information in there. And so is the Roman Lansky book too. So, because we use a combination of the two depending on the student based on our observations and interviews. So
Yeah, absolutely.
we're not
Both of those
stuck
are
on
really good
one, for
resources. We've
example.
learned
So
quite recently from
depends on the
AFB
student.
Press that version 2 of Christine Roman Lansky's cortical visual impairment is due in the spring. And there are some other resources being put together as well. Carrie chimes in. She found the book on Amazon. So that's also available. Many of the books put out by AFB Press are also available electronically, which not only makes them accessible, but you can get it right away. And someone is.
And those of you who are working, those of you who are working for agencies and you have a large VI staff, I think if you buy five books from AFB of the same title,
Nice
you get
tip.
a huge
Nice
discount.
tip. We got a lot of thank yous coming in, so I don't want to discount those. There's a lot
That's
of
what
people
we
saying
did
thank you
last
as
year.
they sign off. We were at capacity today. If you hear your colleagues complaining that they were closed out, the room did close at 100 participants, and we have apologized for that. But as I said, please let them know that this has been recorded. It should be available as early as tomorrow, and all of the PowerPoints and the handouts will be available on that website as well. Those of you who registered ahead of time will get a follow-up message from us that will include all those links. We'll also include a survey, so we love to hear what's working for you, what we could be doing better, and other topics that you're interested in. I'll ask one quick question about your case study, and we'll make that the last question. Mark is asking, did you notice an increase in your student's ability to use his hearing?
No.
No.
He has absolutely no hearing, unfortunately. And it's the damage from the meningitis, so he'll never, he'll never, it's profound. So that the only good thing is for CVI, we don't have to deal with that component of the environment, you know, so we don't, that's one issue because he doesn't have any hearing, but obviously, you know, for him, that's, it's.
Yeah, we have to take that into consideration when we're doing all of our planning. But this particular kiddo's hearing is impacted quite severely.
Yeah. It makes it hard because they can't, he doesn't like to walk, you know, signing, he'll look at people moving their hands, but it's very difficult because he doesn't want to look at
really,
people's faces.
That's
exactly.
So there's a lot of challenges when it comes to.
So the signing, the signing piece was very difficult to begin with and continues to be, I mean, it's improved a little bit because he's actually looking at people now. But he was never when we first started.
Yeah, he's starting to use some basic signs, but it's that was a challenge. But yeah, no, unfortunately, his hearing is not even an option.
And this is where that piece that we talked about, the three types of acuity, is going to be critical. Because from a functional standpoint, you'll need to know where to be.
And did you have a teacher with deaf or hard of hearing on his team? Yeah, okay. So one more area of collaboration.
Yes.
I'm going to let the two of you go back to your teaching, but Valerie, let's leave the room open for a few more minutes. So if people do want to post questions, they can go ahead and post them. And let me thank you all again for joining us, Rajiv and Joanne, for this two-part conversation on.